name is Daryl Scott. I'm a former Woodson Fellow and I'm a historian. And so I kind of want to defend my kin, if you will, from Dr. Walter. I had that conversation about neo-slavery, and it can be a long one, but it's hard for historians who have seen slavery to be an institution that included the breaking up of families, the selling of people, to think of slavery in that way, and then to make a transition to start thinking of dead peons as slavery. And then there are all the other kind of obstacles involved, because not just that you want to say, okay, people are now free, they're not breaking up families, they're not selling people, but the documentation is really hard. For instance, when you first started talking about convict lease, we know there's reform in convict lease. The convict lease is supposed to come to an end by 1910 or so. And so you say, well, but yet the historical evidence to even make your argument as slavery is hard to find in your opinion. And I had a conversation with my grandmother, and this was about an event in 1930. She's passed recently, in which she said that there was a planner who bought the sentence of her significant other, and so she moved on to Captain Joe's plantation, and he had his own cemetery. And I interviewed three times, talked to her, because I take her, because she would never have agreed to be taken. And it's the case that it was really convict lease, a system that was supposed to be gone. Okay? And this was firsthand testimony, because she was on that plantation. Now that she's passed away, I can tell you she had to commit murder to get off that plantation. And so it's hard, you know, as a trained historian, when she started talking to me about this, I'm like, come on, grandma. I'm not saying it like that, but I'm trying to listen from her. Is this a misunderstanding of what's going on? Because this is not supposed to be going on, right? But what it is this is an informal set of arrangements, probably at the county level, that are not supposed to be taking place. Real enough through her testimony, in people's testimony. And some of those people are still alive. And so when we have a Jim Crow conversation, and I'm with you on the Jim Crow, and I've gotten a lot of trouble with people about things like this. Jim Crow was not the most oppressive form in the South at this moment. Lynching, in a way, was the most dramatic thing. But there are other practices in which we know nothing. And they included the killing of people not under the label of lynching. Okay? So there's a need to kind of recreate the evidentiary base before it's actually too late. Okay, because these practices aren't going on. So it's a comment, but at the same time, I understand how we historians can't continue to see it the way you're seeing it after all. And it's not just that people won't give you a degree, okay, or give you tenure. It's just hard to go about the evidence. And so, in defense of what we do, but at the same time agreeing with you, there's a lot more to the story.
Yeah, Mr. Walters, like we thought.
Yes. Well, Daryl, first of all, the arguments that you provided are important but not persuasive. Because if the evidentiary base was not there, I would not have been able to construct this tale. Because the records of the record that I worked with were the national NAACP files, one set of files at the national level. Another set of files were the Justice Department files. And in both of these sets of archives, the record is clear. There is no ambiguity. So that's one of the reasons why I tried to deconstruct what historians have called sharecropping and all of the other things, lend lease and so forth, into a set of conditions. So that if a person lived under these conditions, in the first 50 years after the turn of the century in various places. In fact, they were in slavery. That litany that I read out to you. I'm trying to see this not from the perspective of the historian or the person who's seeking tenure, but I'm trying to see it from the perspective of the slave. And what I'm arguing with you is that we should begin to see it through the eyes of the person who was enslaved. That we have spent too much time seeing this from the eyes of the people who have written the history. And those people who stand over our tenure. I looked at some of the major history textbooks, for example. The Caden, Schlesinger, etc. 7 or 8 of them. Just to see how they handled this story. Now, first of all, the story was almost non-existent. John Hope Franklin was the only one who talked about it to any degree. But yet, these are the major history textbooks that have educated millions and millions of students on the subject. We cannot continue to see this story from their eyes. We have to see it from the evidentiary base that is there. So I want to be tough on you. The discussion I had with Doug was that he didn't even deal with the National Archive documents that I was dealing with. He was dealing with state-level archives. They're in a lot of the courthouses. He says that there are literally hundreds of thousands of documents in these various states that provide an evidentiary basis for the story. What that says to me is something that is very plain, Daryl. Historians haven't done their job. I'm going to be tough on you. You have not done your damn job. Because the records are there. That's not an argument. Well, we could. But what I'm saying, since I'm on the podium, is that I was, one of the reasons why I was astounded as a political scientist is that I ran across the records accidentally. I'll say one more thing, and then I'll shut up. The way I ran across it was I got a call. I'd been doing a lot of work on reparations. And I got a call from a lawyer. They had located a woman in Louisiana. And she said, this woman claims that her family was in slavery in 1960. And she asked me, could this be true? You'd been doing a lot of work on reparations. I said, well, I don't know. I said, but I have just read a half-page story in the Washington Post, written by a guy named Len Cooper, who is in 1995, who says that his family, this is a story in his family, and Len Cooper says he went over to the National Archives, and sure enough, he dug up some of these records. So I went over there, and that's how I got in touch with these records. Now, the Nightline, Peter, turns out that Nightline was interested in doing this story. And what I didn't know was that they were trying to make a decision. So this lawyer told them to send their staff to me. I took the staff down to the National Archives. They looked at the record, and they did the story. So you will find in my book this transcript, Mae Miller and her family in 1960. So the evidentiary base of this is not missing. It is a question of interpretation. And what I'm challenging you to do is to, first of all, dig up the records. And when you look at the records, the ambiguity will not be there. But then to see it through the eyes of the people who are writing these documents and telling you about their condition in the first 50 years of the 20th century.
You may have made the challenge to you with a challenge, I'm sure not just to you. So whose responsibility is it? Who else? In fairness, I should probably give you a chance, but I want to open it up to other people. Who else would like to? I'm asking people to introduce themselves and their affiliation.
My name is Irvin Jordan, and I work in this building. My office is right next door.
Yeah.
We've been talking about environmental racism in space. I'm sure that any one of our panelists, if they had time, would have also touched upon the subject of the disrespect of black cemeteries. And here in Charlottesville, we've had two of those fairly recently. I was on a task force dealing with the Kitty Foster Cemetery, which was located across from the university. And the university at one point was a little skeptical about that. But even white people in the neighborhood said, there's always been a black cemetery. And one gentleman told us that he said they used to play among the gravestones. The university wouldn't do anything about excavating that until it decided it wanted to build a South Lawn project. And now that cemetery will be respected. At Monticello, one of the great issues about Monticello is that given all the Jefferson slaves, you know, several hundred, there's a slave cemetery up there for a second. Recently, a few years ago, they discovered some slave remains, but they believe were slave graves. At first, some of the folks in Monticello wanted to claim that they were graves of Confederate soldiers. And being a Civil War historian, I was asked to come up and take a look at everything. I said, no, these are slave graves. They said that they weren't slave graves. And I said, well, there are children's remains in these. And they said, well, maybe they were the children of Confederate soldiers. Visited them and died of smallpox. Temporary, the smallpox hospital. But anyway, my point is, I'm sure you, as I said, if you had time, you would have. But I would like to know your comments about how black cemeteries are disrespected, particularly in the South.
See, actually, one of the things that I didn't get to among the sites that the highway desecrated, and by the way, this whole desecration of the important black institutions, I'm calling it a punishment. Not only do the highways actually segregate, create these territories of disenfranchising, but there's also a kind of a punishment, like the Booker T. Park. Actually, you know, the idea of putting the dump in a park named for Booker T. Washington, who was a Virginian. You know, it's kind of really telling. The street on which the high school is located and the Juvenile Justice Center was named Oliver Hill Drive. Okay, so I think there is a kind of it almost seems like a punishment for challenging the status quo. But near the courthouse, at a place where there is a huge banner on a building of Obama as the Joker, huge banner, right at that site is a very large cemetery. And you can look, some of my students have looked and they've seen it marked on the site. Plus, I'm looking at the landscape. I know of these cemeteries in Georgetown. I know of the one in Canada. The similar kind of configuration, a similar kind of relationship to dominant culture and the black servicing community in the valleys. So there's a large one, and years ago, the Broad Street Bridge, Broad Street I think this was in early 1900, that ran right through the cemetery, and then today the highway itself comes through there. That same very area is also the place where Gabriel Prosser was executed, you know, and in fact the stones at the bottom of his execution site were actually incorporated into the bridge. When I went there recently, I noticed that someone had put an erasure shrine there, which just tells you how people resist.
In Roanoke, one of the things that happened, as Professor Grandison is talking about, when they built Interstate 581, which goes to the city, graves of African Americans were moved to facilitate the building of the interstate. Springwood Burial Park that I mentioned, it was allowed to grow up and become a sort of nuisance in which there are all kinds of things going on there that were illegal, that were unsanitary. But the city does nothing about this. And so only a couple of, maybe 2 years ago, did they even clear this cemetery, and it had been allowed to overgrow for about 40 years. And so this issue of the degradation of cemeteries is a real one. Hits hard to the people in Roanoke.
I would say when you wish to dominate, settlers actually built on Native American burial grounds. If you look at notes on the states of Virginia, Mr. Jefferson goes about examining Indian skulls, and of course he destroys the mound of Native American burial grounds right here in Charlottesville, and says that he's then given the claim as the first archaeologist. Okay, I am very worried. In fact, I would say this publicly. I'm very worried because in Richmond, they are hoping to excavate the burial ground that's near Broad Street, as was done in New York City. And I'm very much against that because I think the respect that we normally give to cemeteries as of the culture should be accorded black people. We are not just past culture to be excavated by for scientific inquiry that we call archaeology.
Mm. Well, yeah, and this is just an insertion to that. There was a time that black burial grounds were routinely raided.
Absolutely.
For cadavers, for medical students, transported across state lines. Yeah, so you're right. All of the sacredness to which we culturally assign the remains of the dead have never been assigned or extended. That reverence and that sacredness has never extended.
In fact, we actually violate that because it's a form of domination. It's real interesting that you mentioned that. Right there, because of the proximity of the Medical School of Virginia, that black cemetery being there becomes very convenient. And there's actually in the oral history that, in fact, bodies were raided.
Thank you. I saw two hands. Did you want to comment about the cemetery?
No.
Okay, so I'm going to go with this gentleman first.
I'm Gordon Hill, and I'm currently teaching at the law school here. This is a question inspired by your use of the term punishment. Mm-hmm. Assuming rightly or wrongly the decision is made that we need a dump near the city, or we need a highway going through the city, it seems to me that there are several explanations for the factors of both of you, or the phenomena both of you describe. One, it could just be, well, we have to put it somewhere. The black people just won't complain, or they'll accept it. It'll be less political cost of just putting it there, so we'll put it there. I mean, bad, but not quite as pernicious. So another possibility is that it's being used just to reinforce residential segregation. Right? Like the city segregated, we want to use these structures to keep it so. And then the third possibility is the one that I think you're emphasizing, that it is in some way a form of punishing people, either for their activism or perhaps the desire of just driving them out altogether. So I'm just curious, from the perspective of the historian, how does one know which of those three it is? How does one go about sort of trying to excavate the sort of white motive in these cases?
Well, again, I think you look at the archives, the written evidence is there. For instance, in that very same plan, it was definitely a strategy to remove slum neighborhoods. Now, slum just simply was code for black, okay? Because a lot of you can actually see the buildings that were condemned, and a lot of them were very substantial structures because in that moment of the 20s, that late Jim Crow period, we had the black doctors, you had the black middle class oftentimes living in these very same neighborhoods. So a lot of the structures like the Hippodrome that were destroyed actually were quite substantial, should not have been called slum. But I think also when you look at the spatial evidence, like that map that I gave you, those points, you can actually see the convention center removed the first black nurses training school, that school where Maggie Walker taught, the Lancaster School, that's number 16, I believe, on the map. That was right next to the highway. You could actually map, almost like a scientist, and you say, wait a second, and some of my students are asking, why is there such a correspondence? You see?
I think the first thing you do is look at the actual language that city councilmen or whoever is making the decisions, the language that they're using. In Roanoke, there were other quarries to use that had been abandoned, for example. Why select this quarry? They know that Washington Park has a certain sort of value to black Roanoke. These other quarries don't have the same sort of value in terms of the space and the local people who are there. Look at the question of the disparate impact of environmental racism that blacks bear. If African Americans are absorbing this disparate impact, then this begins to lead us to a certain kind of conclusion. And one of the other things is the sort of market value of land. We look at how land is even valued through the real estate market. And if this land is cheaper, what is this saying about how we value that space? And so I think that if we add these things up, you can come to a pretty good conclusion as a historian.
I was going to say one other thing. We have just finished a long paper on looking at smart growth and some of the modern sort of urban development theories and the way in which they diminish the interest of the African American community. The economic growth, as a matter of fact, and I just was writing down here this urban renewal model, because I'm looking at modern urban and regional theories, and it goes right back to urban renewal. There was a superordinate interest in economic growth that drove, and these were the arguments that were made in almost every city for these highways. And as a matter of fact, they're still being made on that. In my area, Washington, D.C., the Intercounty Connector, the people who testified on the Intercounty Connector were making economic development arguments to connect 270 with 495 that drove you up to Baltimore. And so there is a theory which suggests that the interest of the majority, the cultural, political interest of the majority, will come out in terms of public policy. And these interests, the economic interests, have been dominant. And now I think we're into a new series. The reason why I wrote this piece is because there is a new White House Office on Urban Policy. And looking at the philosophy, the beginning philosophy of that office, we ought to have reason to be a little bit concerned. Because what they are doing is that they're adopting the economic growth arguments of the previous urban planners. And if they adopt these arguments as the new philosophy of the Office of Urban Development, it will have the same output.
We have time perhaps for one more question. People may not think it's money.
We just have time for one more?
Well, we'll pass the time to this.
It's 22.
Exactly. As Dr. Wilkinson is fighting for sanitation workers in much the same way that King fights for sanitation workers 5 years later, he's concerned about the conditions in which black laborers operate, the sort of hernias, the back pain. In 68 with King, folks, this sort of environmental movement, it's not just a labor movement, right? It's about environmental policy. There are two black people who were killed who were working on the backs of these trucks. And so the question of environmental racism goes directly to the body. What do you breathe in? What do you eat? When kids are going to these dumps and they're raiding the dumps for chips that are too stale to sell to white Roanoke and for cakes, what's being ingested in their bodies? And so a concern about environmental racism means that you are concerned about public health, but you're also concerned about black humanity and what they eat and breathe every day.
Oh, I guess, you know, if the overarching issue is a sort of difficulty America has with truly welcoming blacks as into the American citizenry, it's very difficult, given the opportunities, advantages of being a citizen, to maintain the body, you know, when it's denied.
If I could devour the last word, I wanted to ask go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to say that the issue of the black body with respect to 20th century slavery was somewhat different than in pre-Civil War slavery because of the issue of commodification. The commodification of the black body under plantation slavery, as we knew it before 1865, I did have to do a lot of families. and the wish on the part of the plantation owner to keep this unit intact so that he could exploit the labor of this family. After the turn of the century, the commodification of the black body became to be more harsh, and that's why people said that it was worse than slavery, because they took away, you see, this, a lot of the setting. And the concern had to be, or came to be, only with the person's labor. So that in that case, if the person didn't perform, they could simply do away with the person. And that's one of the reasons why the violence went up, was so worse. So that the issue of the Industrial Revolution, the commodification of the black body, and all of these, not just through plantations, but in all of these other industries, came to be an essential problem that really fueled this thing past past the 20th, the turn of the century. Final thing I'll say is that the NAACP, I think, learned that you can't deal with this issue of the black body as they were having being made to deal with it one at a time. That the law, the use of the law, and when you look at Moorfield Story and White and Houston and all these people, they were outstanding attorneys. What they were doing was saying, we want to have now an impact on Thurgood Marshall, throw him in there later on, public policy. Because bodies equal community. And through public policy, we can have far more, we could protect the black body far more if we can have an impact upon public policy that will protect the community. And that's what I think drove them precipitously in that direction. And particularly because in the 1930s, they began to be successful in using the law. And of course, 1954 was the year that sort of took them away from this dealing with the black body altogether.
So I was going to ask the sort of moderator's prerogative here. So each of the scenarios you're describing may have ended, but the legacy hasn't ended. So Tim, the shutting down of the landfill, you close an unlined landfill, but the leachate is going to continue there. It's going to need monitoring for generations. You're going to have methane. Ian, you know, you're not going to build any more ice, but you've got that divide that's there.
They continue in other ways.
So. Ron Duffy, the people that whose family, whose parents have lost income, lost education, and so forth. So, what would constitute repair? Is repair possible? Who would be doing what?
I think in the case of Ronald, the city government needs to, and arguably the state government, needs to reconvene. Many of these people are still living who grew up in Washington Park, who grew up going to these schools. And look at the question of public health. Look at how their health care as children was affected. Did they struggle with asthma? Did they contract rabies from a bite, from a rat? How do we sort of wrestle with that? And then think about this question of reparations locally. And we have to ask the question. If we don't ask the question, no one else will.
I guess I am becoming a little more pessimistic in my middle age. Because I really believe that the overarching problem of a very intractable racism makes, I mean, repair. You know, even as we speak right now, blacks are through the whole system of tax incentive for real estate and bond ratings of cities are being pushed out of these very same neighborhoods that were severed. And they're going to the margins where I fear that poverty and race will become invisible, much as it is in relation to Paris, France, where we didn't know that blacks and dispossessed people were there until the riots. Okay, so I am not optimistic. It just reconfigures.
Well, my last book was on reparations, and so after muddling through that, I just don't think that America anytime soon is going to come to the point where they would deal with that. I just would say one thing about that. Dealing with problems of education is not dealing with reparations, because I make a distinction between the distribution of the benefits of society according to the normal distribution level and what was owed to us back then and what is still owed to us today. So there is a distinction, it seems to me, between those two things. There is a huge, huge debt that the normal distribution of public policy and resources today will not deal with. And one of the reasons we know that is because the construction of general public policy, normal public policy under normal conditions, generally will not deal with the disproportionate suffering of African Americans or other groups. You have to target those groups to deal with the disproportionate suffering. We are facing that situation right now. And the problem I have is that we have a president who is constructing normal public policy under general conditions, and his people think that by doing that, you're going to deal with problems of intractable poverty in the black community and so forth. You will not be able to do it. And if you don't believe me, look at a brand new book by William Julius Wilson that just came out, where he takes the position that I'm taking at this moment. But final thing I'll say about that is that this spring I did a poverty tour in the Delta, and many of the people that I talked about, their descendants are still there. When the cotton system became mechanized, it pushed a lot of thousands of black families up off of the land, but often to communities of 2,000, 5,000, 10,000. And these people live in the most miserable conditions imaginable. AIDS rampant, unemployment rampant, isolated because there's no public transportation. Women telling me that you have to drive 100 miles to see a doctor, 50 miles to go to school. And it's almost like I went to Marks, Mississippi, and this huge poster on one corner of the mule train that Dr. Martin Luther King used to pull out of Marks in 1969. But Marks is just like it was then. It's almost as if the civil rights movement happened in the South, and a lot of people left and went up north, but thousands of black people are still there in the worst conditions today. We have a third world in our country, and we don't advocate for it. We pay it little attention. So I don't know. I mean, the problem of dealing with them in terms of repair is that they live under some of the most still repressive political systems. But when I was down there, the governor was saying, we don't need stimulus money. That's the political system. So how can you repair that situation when you have that kind of superordinate political structure? Hopefully, this administration, and if he's around 4 more years, will find a way around that oppressive political system, because that not only is from the top, but the oppressiveness of that political system has permeated down through counties, down through the legislature, down through the local level. We were bringing in food and clothing into a number of these places, and yet we found black elected officials on the ground who were saying, those people just want to live like that. So that has to be broken up some kind of way. And it seems to me that many of the people who benefited from the civil rights movement have to turn their attention back to those places where black people are trapped. And these are the descendants of the people that I talked about. Many of them are still there today.
No, let us let that linger in the air. I don't need to ask anything else. Let us tear it to the lobby.
Let's offer thanks first before we do that.